You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 189. Filmmakers are going to make films just like painters are going to paint. Richard Linklater.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft. It's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro-budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. Today's show is also sponsored by Indie Film Hustle Pro, our private and growing community for filmmakers and screenwriters. It was created for film creatives like you to meet, network, and support each other, learn from film industry experts, and to get the answers to your burning questions and more. The journey in this business is rough. There is no guarantee to success, but your chances of reaching your goals dramatically improve when you find others who are on the same journey as you and you work together towards a common goal. That is why I put together IFH Pro. Inside, you'll get professional networking, private and safe spaces to discuss the film business, access to advanced tools and education, up-to-date education, exclusive content not available publicly, access to IFH Pro workshops, webinars, special guests, and so, so much more. If you want to check it out, head over to indiefilmhustle.com/pro. Now, guys, today on the show, we have a special treat for you. We have the wonderful star of my last feature film I shot, On the Corner of Ego and Desire, Sonia O'Hara. Now, Sonia is not just an amazing actress, but she's also a writer-director in her own right. And I have been watching her career unfold ever since she went to Sundance with me all those years ago. And boy, has she been able to do a lot since then. She's been working with Oscar-nominated actors, blockbuster actors, working on two features and a show, and she's been nominated for an Emmy and so many other things. But what I really found fascinating about Sonia's journey is that she financed her early works, her early films, in a way that I've never heard of before. And I've heard of a million different ways for people, for filmmakers to raise money for their films, but this takes the cake. She literally sold her eggs, and they're called designer eggs, so people can buy her eggs and make a baby somewhere else with her eggs. She sold her eggs to finance her first film and her first series as well. And she made a whole movie about the process because it was so insane. And I had to talk to her about what was that like, how'd she do it, what happened, all that stuff. This is by far one of the most interesting stories of film financing I have ever heard. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Sonia O'Hara. I'd like to welcome to the show Sonia O'Hara. How are you doing, Sonia?
Quite good. Thank you so much for having me, Alex. I'm excited to be here.
Oh my God. I'm so excited to have you on the show. People from the tribe might recognize you as the star of my last feature film, On the Corner of Ego and Desire. And we've, I mean, you've, I'm not going to say you've turned into Julia, because
a little bit
because you're now directing a whole hell of a lot, but you're definitely not the crazy director that you played in the show.
Definitely played an extreme version of, like, you know, the worst way that I could ever become, but
no. It was, so let's talk a little bit about, just for everyone listening, how we met and how we originally worked together, and then kind of how that, and we'll go, and that takes us to certain directions. So how did we originally meet, and how did we work together?
Well, I had a mutual friend, a filmmaker named Rob Alicia, and Rob had told me that he was going to do this crazy experiment where he went to Sundance to, he was going to go to Sundance to act in a mumblecore film by this dude who is a director and also a noted podcast host. And I started, like, doing all my research, and I was like, this guy's real. Like, he has a movie on Hulu right now that I was, like, checking out. And I was like, wow, I'd kill to do that movie. And he's like, you know, I think they might still be casting. And then I reached out to you and sort of emphatically was like, I am this character. I can do this. And we had a phone call. And next thing I know, I'm being flown to Park City, Utah. I had never been there. I had never been to Sundance. I had wanted to go to Sundance since I was 14 years old in Nova Scotia. And suddenly I'm, like, living right on Main Street, shooting a movie like 24 hours a day for the week of this thing. And it felt completely surreal. Like, I had never, it was unlike anything that had ever happened to me.
It was so funny because all three of you, all the main characters, you, Robin, and Randy, all of you had never been to Sundance. So when you guys, like, I took you through, I was your guide through Sundance because I'd been there so many times. All your reactions, yes, you were acting fantastically, but most of it was just like, oh my God.
I couldn't believe it. I was just like, the whole time, it was just, you know, you've seen so much, like, footage, like, behind the scenes stuff of these, like, Sundance, like, gifting suites and these Sundance, like all of these places. And we're, like, literally knocking on doors, and we're, like, in the Sundance lobby, like, filming, like, going rogue and filming. And it was...
And I would be getting upset. And I would be getting upset for people getting in my shot. I'm like, and then Austin RDP's like, Alex, we're not supposed to be here. I'm like, I don't care. I'm a director. Get out of my shot.
Yes, that was probably one of my favorite filming experiences ever.
I mean, it was such a, and that, I think that's how I sold it to you too. I sold it to all of you. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, I don't know what's going to come out of this, but at the least you will have an amazing story in 30 years that you'll go, there's this one time I shot a movie at Sundance and this is how it went down. Yeah. At that minimum, you would have that. And, and we did. And we definitely, that definitely a story there.
And I was a little scared at first because you were like, you know, we're going to be a bit disruptive and we're going to go in there and people won't know if it's real or not. And I was like, oh my God, I'm about to be a speaker at South by Southwest. Like, what if people think I'm obnoxious like my character? And then you just forget all of that when you're acting. And, you know, it ended up just being a joy. But I was nervous.
Yeah, I appreciate you thinking that this was as big as the Avengers, that now you would be typecast as the crazy director. But not as many people have seen the film. But but it was really great. And we were so lucky because my producer, my co-producer on the project, Adam, had this ridiculous, ridiculous suite apartment on Main Street. And I still remember we filmed you guys coming in. And the looks on your faces, you were just like, what is going on? It was insane.
It was surreal. And you guys held that party there every year. And suddenly, like, everyone I'm meeting at Sundance, I'm like, you should come to this party. Like, I'm not telling them that it's going to be filmed and part of the movie. I'm just thinking, I'm going to network. Hello, agent. Come to this party.
which brings me to another lovely side story to our adventures at Sundance on the corner of Ego and Desire is that, you know, you were hustling hard from the moment you got there. At the party, we have recorded conversations with you because at the party, for everyone who hasn't seen the movie, there's a big Sundance party there, and basically it's a live party, and you guys are just kind of thrown in there, and we're just kind of like ad-libbing and having a good time.
Yeah.
But you guys were all mic'd. So so while we were setting up a shot, you were literally networking with somebody, and you're like, oh, they're calling me back on set. I got to go. But here's my card. I'll talk to you in a little bit. And I was just like, I heard that in post. I'm like, this girl, man. Oh my God.
I know. I forgot sometimes I even had the love on me, and I would like meet a casting director or something else and was like absolutely schmoozing. And it was, yeah.
And one of those nights, I think it was the night, did you see the Room with Us, or you didn't see The Room with Us?
No. So the night that the casting crew decided to watch The Room, I snuck off to go to the APA agency party because I had seen in Variety a list of parties that were happening for the agencies, and I knew no one that was going. And I just went off and snuck into the party. And mingling that night, I met an entertainment lawyer who ended up making a bunch of introductions to the big agencies and helped me get with my agent, all because I went that night. And I've always thought that, like, if I had stayed in and watched this movie, maybe my career never would have started at all. So it's like a very crazy thing, like just how it was serendipity, you know?
Well, if you would have never done the movie, you would have never had all of these opportunities. So it's so interesting because, you know, we weren't paying the millions yet for our cast at the time of making that movie. So you were just like, I'm just going to go on this adventure. I'm going to just do my thing. But when you were there, you figured out, I gotta hustle this, and I gotta network, and I gotta try to do as much as I can. But it's such a great example of hustle, because I mean, seriously, hustle respects hustle. You're definitely there. So you're like, guys, I know you guys want to sit down and, like, you know, geek out over The Room, and that's great, but I'm going to go sneak into the APA bar party. And all of a sudden, you got your agent there. And then some of the guests that I was recording, you would connect with. You, like, I remember one guest specifically who will remain nameless, got up from the chair after I got done interviewing him, and you bolted.
Descended on this
poor, like, person. This poor man. You were just like a hawk, like on fresh meat. You jumped in and you're like, hi, I'm Sonia. Here's my card. And you eventually connected with that guy, and he's been able to work with him. It's just really, it's really interesting to see how that all worked out. And then as the movie, you know, got made and everything, I kept seeing on Facebook, you know, on social media, how you've been doing stuff. And I was like, well, I mean, she's directing now, and she's like, I know you were a director prior to getting to Ego and Desire.
But before then, I had been doing indie projects on my own, right? Like, I had been doing self-funded micro-budget projects, and one of them ended up getting enough traction that I was, like, on the festival circuit with it and getting to do some, you know, speaking as a panelist to talk about, like, breaking out from just being an actor and as a multi-hyphenate to, like, you know, getting, selling, like, a couple indie shows. But I wasn't yet being hired and offered scripts to direct things as a director for hire. Mm-hmm. And here I am playing this, like, pretentious, like, art film director. He's like taking the world by storm. And then, like, next thing I know, after I do your movie, I'm like, I hadn't even moved to LA yet at that period, because I flew in from New York to do the movie in Park City with you. And then I moved to LA right after that. And then I'm pitching on all of these director for hire jobs and, like, saying some of the same things that Julia says in the movie. And I was like in the movie, like, but then when I'm like, oh, this is like The Shape of Water meets Transformers. Like, I'm still, like, having to, like, say these ridiculous comps when I'm pitching, but people are taking me seriously and giving me money to make the movies. And I'm like, this is very, very surreal.
So that character, when everyone listening goes and watches it, which is available everywhere on Amazon and all sorts of places, you can watch it for free. But, you know, you were an extreme version of directors. But at the end of the day, afterwards, I've had a lot of filmmakers come up to me, and even, you know, high end professionals in the business who've watched the film. They're like, yeah, I know her. Yeah, I know that character. I know I've spoken to that director. I've spoken to that filmmaker a million times. And I'm like, I thought we were really off the reservation personally.
Yeah.
No. We're pretty close to the reservation, apparently.
Yes. Because I think people like that care so deeply, and that pretentiousness comes from insecurity, and you don't yet have an outlet to prove your ability, and you're just so extra. And, like, I'm naturally, like, a type A nerdy person anyway, and hopefully it doesn't manifest in me being a psycho, but I definitely have been, like, over-amped about things. So, you know.
You were built to play that role. There's no question about it. Now, you started off as an actress. So how and why did you want to get into this insanity?
I mean, I have been acting since I was a kid in Nova Scotia. Like when I was growing up, I would see Elliot Page at auditions. And I remember when the movie Hard Candy went to Sundance, like my goal has been Sundance longer than I could ever remember. And at some point I had, you know, moved from Nova Scotia to New York to go to acting school. And then I moved to Los Angeles at 20 years old. And I was Faye Dunaway's personal assistant, which was such a trip.
And oh my God, the stories. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
I know. And she had this production company and she was doing an adaptation of the play Masterclass where she was going to be playing Maria Callas. And I just saw, and she gave me the advice that if you wanted to have any sort of autonomy as an actress, you had to produce your own things. So when I went back to New York and started studying screenwriting, and when I made my first feature at 25, my goal was really just to launch myself as an actor. And then you just fall in love with making movies. And in the process of that, I hired a really lovely director for that feature, but I didn't bring that person on until I had already cast the project and rehearsed the project and like done and blocked it and, you know, was shortlisting it. And I became a director in the process of making that first movie, Ovum. Mm-hmm. And then you just get the bug. And like, I thought, you know, I made like a budget, you know, a $17,000 micro budget feature, which is still bigger in budget than what you did Ego and Desire.
Much bigger.
Right. After that, I had the bug and I just couldn't stop making things, but I still, you know, acting was my first priority and I still act and I still love it. But now the feeling of fulfillment I get from making movies and being part of every part of the creative process is unlike anything else. Like, I mean, you know how it is.
Now I have to ask you though, and I might be mixing the plot with the reality. Yeah. Did you sell your eggs to produce that movie?
Yes. So I sold my eggs and was like writing about the process of selling my eggs to fund my movie. It was like very meta while I was actually selling my eggs at this like, you know, these egg donor clinics in New York where they were looking for designer eggs. And they're like, does she look more like Amy Adams or Emma Stone? Okay, check this box. This is how we're going to pitch her to potential, like, you know, people who wanted like Norwegian eggs and I'm half Norwegian. And it was like a very surreal experience. And I felt like I was auditioning, just like I'd go to a cattle call in New York. And it was the same as being at like an egg casting. And then I wrote about that and then funded the movie. And made like $100,000 selling my eggs. And dudes get like, you know, $75 in a candy bar, but women can make real money. So I made multiple projects with the egg money. And it was,
you know what? Wild. So Adam, so listen, I've heard everything. I've literally heard every which way to raise money for a movie. I've heard it either through my show or through people I know or just through watching the industry. I've never heard of this. This is the first time I've ever heard of any film director selling her eggs and producing multiple projects with her egg money.
Oh, yeah. Egg money was really like this golden goose for a long
time. No pun intended.
And now one day, you know, there will be like 18-year-old egg babies that see a billboard for one of my movies. And they're like, is that mommy? Like, yeah. I know it's going to happen. But,
talk about commitment. I mean, I don't know how many dudes out there would sell their eggs if they had them.
And there was a day that I had to go from my egg surgery for my first round of egg donation to acting in a film where I had to go through an exorcism in a field. And you're supposed to be like on bed rest. And I'm like launching around, like lying in a field and getting shot. And like, it was really, they were like, you should, you know, like be, you know, in bed for like 3 days. And I was like, I gotta act. Like, this is why I'm doing it. Act or die, you know? So
the thing I love about you is your tenacity. You have a tenacity. You have an energy. That energy that you brought to Julia in my movie, there is parts of Julia within you. There's no question. Yes, the extreme versions are funny and everything like that. But this, you know, it wasn't a stretch. Like, I didn't know that when I cast you about all of this. I'm like, oh, I knew you'd direct and stuff. But as I started working with you and I started seeing your now over the last few years after watching you grow as a filmmaker and as an artist, I'm like, you are so tenacious, which is such a lesson for everyone listening. It's like, I'm sure you had a billion no's. And still getting.
Yes. And I just, like, everyone goes on social media and we share the highlight reel of what we're doing, but we get no's constantly. We get no's from festivals. We get no's for offers from movies. I audition for big things that go to stars all the time. No is such a standard, but it's stopped even factoring into my confidence. Like, I don't even care about the no's. Like, I don't even ruin my day anymore. Like, I used to be really sad if I'd lose out on a role. Now it's like I close those emails and it's like 1 second later, it doesn't even like stay in my psyche. Like, I'm now actually past rejection. I wish I could say it was like that in the dating world, but when it comes to work, I am like impervious to rejection.
Oh, the heart. The heart is what the heart is. There's no question. Now, you did get a chance to work as an actor on some pretty big sets in network. What were some of the biggest lessons that you pulled from working on those big sets, you know, that you have brought into your own directing?
I mean, I think that there are many directors that don't really talk to actors on set and are so much more focused on working with their DP, and actors just sort of feel like moving props. And there were many times that I just felt like I'm seeking some sort of validation that I'm wanting to make bold choices or something, that my choices are landing. And I felt like a lot of the time, people just didn't really care. Like, you were just like a moving prop to many filmmakers, not the great ones, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I knew that I wanted to take care of everyone on my set as a director. And I don't care if you're a day player, if you have one line, if you're a featured background. Like, I wanted everyone to feel like they were part of it as a collaboration. Because when I feel safe and celebrated, I feel like as an actor, I can make bold choices. And when I feel ignored, I feel small. And then I'm more likely to, you know, not do anything that's especially spontaneous, right?
Right, because you're not feeling, I always tell people, like, actors want to feel safe. And
that's it.
They want a safe environment. So I'd love to hear your perspective on, and I don't mean to keep going back to Ego and Desire, but it is our experience together working as an actor and a director. You know, that was a very intense and wild experience. I just met you that day. Yeah. I had never physically met you, any of the cast. Yeah. It was all through Skype.
Like one Zoom. Yeah, exactly.
It was just like, we did a Zoom and that was it. So then when we met, you had to figure me out pretty quickly.
Yes. And you are so good at fostering a sense of, you are warm and kind, and the way that you are on your podcast is exactly how you are in person. So like, I felt safe to make choices and to fall on my face and like be ridiculous. And you'd given me a scriptment of the beats that we wanted, but you were so open to me playing and taking like chances with things. And that just makes you feel emboldened to make choices and have a real performance. Like, I'm often afraid of directors, and I think many actors are that way too. Mm-hmm. And that just doesn't give people the, you know, it doesn't make people feel ready to like take on the world if they're like, you know, afraid to make choices.
Right. Absolutely. Because if you don't feel safe, then you're not going to not only give your biggest, you're not going to give your all, but you're also, some actors might act out. Some actors will be in a protective mode and say, hey, I'm just going to take care of me, because obviously you're not going to take care of me. Yes. So I'm going to just do me, not listen to you. And then this is where problems occur, because the director did not foster that environment of like, you are in a safe space. No one's going to hurt you here. No one's going to judge you here. Let's try. Let's play. Because that whole movie was trying and playing. We were all on an adventure. Like, I literally got on the plane and didn't know if I had a movie. Like, you asked me, like, do you have something? And I'm like, I think so. Like, I don't know if I'm going to make my 73-minute deadline that I wanted to make over 70, like I think it was 70, over 70 minutes. I think Mark Duplass once said, if it's over 70 minutes, it's a feature. So I'm like, I just need to make enough. I need to shoot enough to get over. But we had no time to look at footage. Like, I just saw, I glanced by and like, I bring you over. I'm like, here, this is a cool shot we got, or here's a performance. But we had no time. We were running. We were shooting. Yeah. We were like constantly. One night, by the way, I have to call you out on the one night that we shot on Main Street, in the morning. We woke up at the crack ass of dawn to go shoot the movie poster shot. That whole sequence, the snow was falling, the lights, remember the whole lights were all dimmed up on Main Street?
Like, it looked like we were on this like beautiful studio lot.
Right.
There just happened to be no cars going down Main Street. We had it to ourselves. I was able to stand in the middle of the snow on the road and just look up at like the Egyptian Theater in awe, like genuine awestruck.
It was, but you unfortunately made the one choice that I know you regretted, which was the pant choice that you made at the beginning of the movie.
Yes, I decided that I thought I wanted to look like hip and hot and wear fucking leather pants and high heels on like icy, like total rookie move. Cause like I listened to your podcast and it was like, wear double warm socks, like wear flat shoes, bundle up. And I'm in these like stylish freaking leather pants. Then I was like, oh, great. And I was freezing and I'm like shivering and dying, but that she would wear leather pants. So I stand by
your choice. But the thing was beautiful too, is you never, ever complained. None of you did. No one complained. I think the only complaint I heard was when we were at the party and we were shooting outside and the boys didn't have their shirts on. I mean, not their jackets on. They had their shirts on. And I just pulled them out there. And for a normal conversation that takes 4 or 5 minutes, you might be able to pull it off with maybe just a sweater. But we were out there for an hour. I had
like a major confrontation scene.
And I had a parka. You had your jacket on. Yes, like,
yes. And they were just shivering. And they were such good sports about it, but I could see they were freezing. Like, you can see their breath. Like, they're using it. But like, poor Randy is like, you know.
It was insane. Now, you got an opportunity, right? Shortly after we worked together to direct your first feature as a work for hire because of all of these things. By the way, I'm still waiting for my residual checks, but we'll talk about that later. No, I'm joking. But what was it like for you walking on the set for the first time on that kind of project? That's not your project. You're a work for hire. What's that feeling like?
It was pretty intimidating. I was lucky in that I got to bring my long-term DP from Brooklyn. I got to fly him to Louisiana. And we had made so many projects on shoestring budgets that we have sort of an intuitive way of how we work. So, but it was still hard to convey this sort of small way of working to suddenly being on a big set. Like he's such an indie DP that he wanted to be camera operating. And they were like, what do you mean? You're the cinematographer. Like, we're going to give you a team. And he's like fighting to operate his own camera. And I am fighting to hire actors that I know and trust that will give me great performances. And they're like, we have the money for some names. And you're like, okay. And you're just sort of like expanding. Like, there's so many times that I didn't have the sets to be able to do these epic, beautiful wides. And I'm having you do these tight claustrophobic shots. And suddenly, you know, you're on a real set with real production designers and things that I just didn't have access before to. And it sort of just expands, you know, you're able to do things you were never able to do before. And that was great. There were some ageism problems where I felt like there were older local crew members that I look like I'm like freaking 19 years old half the time. And like, I'm on set and I always direct in like a floral dress and I have like no makeup and I'm like this like happy, like, and I don't seem like the typical director, like a man with authority that holds space.
Where's your monocle? You didn't have a monocle? I mean, nothing.
And like, there was one day that I showed up with like no makeup, hair in a ponytail and like a t-shirt and sneakers. And someone thought I was a PA on my own set where I was a director. You know, and it's like, you can't take any of it. Like, I had no ego about it. But for the first week, I felt like judgment and side eye from these like really seasoned crew. Like, half of them had just come off doing a whole season of Queen Sugar. And then they're like on my movie. And it's my first time with like a real crew in these numbers of people. But by the second week, they got what I was doing, you know? And then I'm still trying to do little indie filmmaker things. Like, I'm trying to get my like Terrence Malick like shot at magic hour and we're like about to lose the sun and all the departments are like, last looks, and the scriptie is like, this isn't in the script, and you're like, oh god, I just want to be able to be creative and get this shot of my ingenue on a swing. And you know, there are things that just get lost in translation to make bigger films.
So that first week when you're, because I was going to ask you that, because look, I was at one time, I know it's hard to believe, the young guy on set. I at one point I was always the young person in the room. You are still the young person in the room, but one day soon, you will not be the youngest person in the room. But I remember walking on sets. I was directing commercials and I would have this DP, or I would have this production designer, or I would have this first AD who'd been around for 1,000 years. And they look at this, who's this kid? And they start trying to, you know, puff up their chest and like, no, you really don't know what you're talking about, kid. And that there was no respect there. How did you deal with that as a first time, not a first time filmmaker, but a first time filmmaker in this scenario?
Yeah. I mean, I luckily had producers that believed in me, that I had come in and had beaten out more like, you know, filmmakers that had far more resumes than me, because I'd responded to this certain script and I knew an exact vision of how I would do it. And I had impressed them in the like phase when I was like making mood boards and cutting together sizzles and doing all these things to get this job. So they knew that I had a vision and I was passionate.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And the actors understood it. And because I'm an actor first, I speak actor, and there's no person on that set that's not going to feel like I care about their performance. So me and the actors are always good. But there is some issue sometimes with crew members that, like, often it's the first AD. They've done a million movies. Often they went to AFI. They like are really qualified, and they see me as this like young person who maybe has gotten a job because of optics right now, or in a post-Me Too world. And it's proving that, sure, absolutely, women are getting jobs, but I also have a voice and a vision, and I can do this, and I'm not going to do it the way someone else would, and I might make mistakes, but I'm going to deliver a movie with heart that's good and has a unique point of view, but I might just do it in my own way. Right. And trying to act like other directors is not going to be the way that I accomplish that. So I learned, the first while I was trying to be like every other director on set, and now I throw that out and I'm the free-spirited little happy director, and I know that I'm not like everyone else, but my way works too. It's just a different way. And now, I've gotten better with that.
So, you know, that I've had many female directors on set. Mm-hmm. On the show, because I always love to hear their point of view and their experience, because it's an experience that I just don't understand, because I'm not a woman. And I had to deal with my own things, you know, being a Latino filmmaker coming up, and there was a whole thing that I had to deal with coming up as a commercial director. But as a female director, I have to imagine that, you know, you got not only ageism, but just guys who are just like, who is this chick, and how dare she direct? And it could be
film trivia at me. You know, they're trying to like catch me up. You know,
they're like, "Have you? You know, let's do this scene. You know, like that scene that Ridley did on Blade Runner." And you're like,
"Yes, yes." And like, I've started to just own what I know and what I don't know. Because I think that if somebody catches somebody posturing and pretending they know something that they don't, that's more of a way to lose them. And I might have different references than they do, right? And I might be talking about shots on Euphoria, and they might be talking about Rashomon. But that's okay. You know, we can find different ways, and there's like a different way to meet in the middle and still make great movies.
But as far as, I mean, because you have the pressure of being a director, you know, on your first big set, and then you've got also these situations, and you actually very eloquently said it, you know, they might because of optics, you know, oh, that's why she got this job. Yeah. You know, as a creative, you have enough stress just doing the job, let alone with all this other stuff. Is there any tips that you can give other, you know, female directors or other young directors who have to deal with things that might not affect other directors of different ages or races or so on?
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of the time, the things that people are saying when they're upset, it's more that they wish they had that opportunity. It's not really about you and your work. It's their own frustration about where they are at that moment. Like, largely things aren't personal, and largely people don't really care about you, the other person, right? They're just like endowing this situation with all the other people that they've met that maybe weren't deserving, and maybe that person who's your first AD, your second AD, is actually a killer filmmaker, and I wish that they would get these opportunities too. But what I say is, like, I didn't just get handed a job because of being a nepotism hire, right? Like, I'm from no money in Nova Scotia, Canada. Like, my mother remortgaged her house to send me to acting school in this country, right? Like, I'm not from any of it. And I just made micro budget things for a long time because I loved movies, not so somebody would hand me, you know, a movie. Like, I didn't have any of those like aspirations. I just like to make good, weird, creative work. And it's just like finding those like-minded weirdos who want to hire me to do it. So I largely don't let these haters on set, you know, hurt me or get me down. And often they become my friends, like the very people that doubt me the most. I often learn a ton from them because I don't have an ego about it. And there's so much like I have to learn, right? I'm a good filmmaker, but there's so much more I can learn. And I've just become like kind of zen of like, it's okay. I'm going to make a good movie. We're all in this together. It's fine. You might not get me, but you'll know my name, you know, my attitude about it.
I always, you know, for me, I've told this story on the show before, but I think it's a story that needs to be repeated. I was on a show once that I was producing the show, the whole series. I was a director, and we were under a lot of stress. We didn't have a lot of budget, but you know, we were able to shoot this whole show. And I had this older first AD who didn't know who I was, not that I am anybody, but understood it. Didn't do enough research to know that this is someone who's been directing for 25 years at the point that I did it. So I thought I was, you know, who's this person? Who's this guy? And was giving me crap on day one. And I had to pull him aside and I said, hey, man, look, I've been doing this for a long time. And I did it and I pulled him aside. Sometimes you got to show teeth, but I never show teeth publicly because that's disrespectful.
That's wild. Yes.
Always quietly, hey, can I talk to you for a second? And I'm like, hey, man, I've been doing this for a long time. I don't appreciate the way you're treating me. And I've done this so much that between me and my DP, I don't need you. And I can do, I don't need a first AD on this gig. I can do this by myself. So if you don't act right, you're fired. And from that moment on, biggest cheerleader, he was, yes, sir. No, sir. Because he finally realized, oh, okay. This guy understood, and he was a frustrated director, and it's okay. It had nothing to do
with the day, and they can't try to make other people on your crew think poorly of you because of their bad attitude. And I've definitely had things where the crew has listened to my DP, who's a man, instead of me, and were like laying down dolly tracks for something that I was hadn't approved. And there are times that I have to just be okay being like, so that's not what we're doing. And you know,
so children, come back to the table. This is not what we're doing.
And people joke that on set, like my DP calls me Miss O, like I'm Miss Frizzle from the little, like, you know, on set, because like I do, I'll be like a really nice kindergarten teacher. But when people are condescending, I'm like, that's not how we're doing it. And then we like, you know, get back to what I meant to do. And we get our
That's a great way, a non-abrasive way of doing it. Yeah. And people, I mean, you got to be pretty heartless to not react to that in a good, positive way. There's only so much of that you can take before you just go, okay, I'm fine.
And you have to make your day. And like, there are times that it becomes bigger than me. And if people are getting in the way of that, I'm like, okay, we literally have to. And right now I'm only having to shoot maximum maybe 5 pages a day. And you've told me stories about how many bajillion pages that you're doing. And I have such respect for that. But, you know, I'm like, I have to make my day. I can't go over budget. And there's like a pressure there that's bigger than me and like my sentiments towards like making art and a beautiful collective, you know?
Right. It's a really fascinating conversation. It really is. Yeah. And like that one show, by the way, we shot 96 pages in 4 days. And
that's insane.
And it was with Austin, my good buddy and DP, who's the best. And we were able to just knock it out. But it was just so funny because I just had to remind the first idea. I'm like, dude, I'm literally paying you. Like, it's my production company producing this. Like, dude, I'm your boss.
And I do that all the time in LA where I go to a party and people imagine that I'm just an actress or I'm somebody's girlfriend. And it's like a bunch of crew guys that I could hire that I'm like crewing up for my next movie.
Right.
And it's DPs talking down to me and acting like I don't know anything about cameras or lenses. And they're talking about like glass and like all this stuff. And they just think that I don't know. And I might remain silent, but I'm like, you could have had a job and you just took yourself out of the running for this because you're being sexist.
And right. And never judge a book by its cover. Never judge a book by its cover. It's just old mentality. It's an old mentality of look. And that's how, like, you know, when I was a younger filmmaker, they did that to me. They just would like, you know, they would like, oh, this is a PA. I'm like, nah, dude, I'm the director of the show.
I know. Yeah. But and then they get my card and they see that I'm with a mega agency. And then there's like this quick about face and how they treat me. But it's, you know, you want to work with your friends. You just want to work with like cool, down to earth people that are going to be lovely when you're doing a 14-hour day.
Right.
So if you have an attitude, it's just not going to work, you know?
Now, on that first project or in either of the, you know, either two features that you've finished, there's always that day that we all directors have that the whole world's coming down. Crashing down around you. What was that day for you and how did you overcome that obstacle?
Yeah, I had an actor on a project that had a really strong emotional response to, he just wanted more coverage and he wanted us to spend more time on a scene and the show must go on, and I'd gotten what I needed. And there was an actor who just had a full out breakdown and was threatening to like call their agents, and we're talking like histrionics and like blaming everyone and not seeing logic, and it's going to cost our day. Like the actor was like refusing to do a stunt, and we had like all of these things set up. And there are times that I think that so much of directing is just people skills and being able to step up and be a leader and be like a freaking, like, I just have to like spin things and be kind and support, because like, I'm knowing that I have to make my day. I'm against the clock. I'm being told by the producers that I have to be able to get this particular actor to like do his thing. And I'm just having to like hold hands and stroke egos and all this stuff that I wonder if I'd have to do if I were a man, to be honest. Mm-hmm. But I got the person around. I like convinced them. And on another movie too, I had an actor who didn't have enough time. I was kind of a star who didn't have enough time for hair and makeup. And she just wanted to like blow our day because she had the power to do so. And each time it's sort of like me getting like having an out of body experience and being like, okay, I have to convince people to do the thing that I need for to get the movie through it. And I just like, I don't know. It's like my blood pressure is through the roof, but I'm just looking this actor in the eye and like holding their hand and saying, we can do this, and convincing them to come to set. And it's just, I've had a number of those things.
So it's interesting. But, I mean, I doubt that if Ridley Scott was directing either of those projects that they would have been this issue.
They wouldn't have. There would not have been. Yes. And then later these actors become my biggest ally on social media and in the media and talk about supporting female directors. And I always think it's interesting because the reality isn't always that, you know.
It's interesting because you have to deal with things that – I doubt that first actor who lost his crap,
yeah.
You know, I don't think he would have done it with someone like myself.
No, he wouldn't have. He absolutely wouldn't have. And he's a gifted actor, and like, you know, it's fine, and I forgive. But
no. But yeah, it's completely 100%. But it's but it's great training for a director, because I've had that. I've had actors who either weren't doing their job, and that all comes from insecurity. That guy's. Yeah. That was all insecurity and fear, yeah. and just
fostering. And I have to say that now that the bigger actors, like the marquee names, I've largely had wonderful experiences.
Yes.
Because they don't have any sort of a need to do it. They want to have a smooth day. They want to make this a great cameo or whatever else. And they're lovely. And sometimes I do see like, it takes like a day for them to want to take my specific direction. Like before them, I see them sort of watching out for themselves, and they're worried that if they take a direction from an early career director and it makes them look bad, they're the one that's going to suffer, and it could affect maybe their rate on the next movie. But they watch me direct other actors, and within a day or two, I've won them over. And then we're working together beautifully and in tandem, you know? So it's just... And I think the more movies I do, you're just going to command more respect, you know, ultimately. Mm-hmm. And I just worked with the beautiful Bruce Dern on the last movie, and he was the most supportive, wonderful human ever. Like telling me stories of like working with Hitchcock and like collaborating with Tarantino. And like, I could have sat down and listened to this man talk forever. Like our ADR session was him just like regaling me with stories. And like, it was like the most fun ever. Like he's the coolest human.
And I mean, I've had the pleasure of working with those kind of actors as well. Yeah. And they're old school. They're pro.
Yes.
They come prepared. There is no ego. They're about the work, you know, and it doesn't matter if it's a $1 million movie or if it's a $100 million movie, they're bringing their stuff. But it's interesting that you say that they look at you for those first couple of days because they're protecting themselves. That happens with all directors to a certain extent and all actors, because even from, you know, actors that I've talked to who are very established actors who work with really established directors for the first time, you know, when you're on set, you want to figure out is this going to work? Because you've got basically two titans. So, you know, when Meryl Streep is on set and she's working with Steven Spielberg for the first time, you've got two titans.
Yes.
Now, either one has equal power.
Yeah, for sure.
They're just equal power. So, you know, obviously they played the game long enough that they wouldn't have signed on unless they really felt that they could vibe and things like that. But at a certain point, you just have to figure out, like, how it's one thing to have lunch with somebody and maybe even go away for a weekend and go to, you know, get things like that and hang out with them and all this kind of stuff. But it's another thing being on set. And there was one story I've heard, which is so amazing. There was this one actor, and I can't use their names because it was an off-air story, but it was brilliant. And I'll tell you who the actors are after we stop recording. But there was this very famous actor who was chasing this very famous director. I mean, just chasing him to do this movie. And like, you got to do it. You got to do it. You got to do it. And finally, he broke him down. He's like, okay, let's do the movie.
Yeah.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show. First day on set, that actor tested that director. That director had been directing at that point 40 years. Very well-known director. And the actor, very legendary actor. And he tested him, not to his face, but by his actions. So there was a scene that something happened and there was a PA that was supposed to do something. And he was like, this PA isn't doing the thing the way he's supposed to be doing it. And I want him off the set. And then the director came down and is like, all right, what's going on? He's like, I want him off the set. This is not doing what he's doing right. And he was testing to see how far he could push. And after the fact, then that director, who is just old school, directed a billion freaking things. Like, was a commercial director and he did all this kind of stuff. He's like, you act, you do the thing, let's start again.
Wow.
And never had a problem with him again. But he was being tested by a very seasoned actor to see if he's got control, or am I going to be able to walk all over him? I don't care if he's a seasoned director or not. And the director just called him right there, day one, instantly. And if he didn't do that, the whole shoot would have been hell. But from that moment on, the shoot pretty much ran smoothly with that actor, though. And that actor is known for being difficult sometimes, but he's a genius. So I get it.
Right, totally. And like, there I was like directing Stephen Lang, you know, obviously he's just come up with Don't Breathe franchise. Like, he's amazing and so skilled and he's such a force. But there are times that, like, you know, he just requires a really professional set that moves quickly, and he deserves that because he shows up so ready to go and he knows all these long, huge pages of dialogue. And it's like, I can't have my focus puller doing, like, everything has to go smoothly. And it's like, you just step up your game when you're working with people like that. And like, I learned so much from him. And by the end of the movie, he was like, I want to be in your next movie. And now we have this like beautiful bond. But for the first couple of days, he's watching me, and then we'll go up to the monitor and he's like, that's a stylish shot. And I'm like, thank you. And you know, and it's like, he's looking at all of it.
Because he's really been around. Like, he's been around. He's worked with James Cameron, like, you know.
Exactly. He's talking about working with these people and like having lunch with Dustin Hoffman yesterday. And you're like trying to not be intimidated. And he's not meaning to name drop. He's like, I just worked with Sandy Bullock this week. And I'm like, awesome. You know?
Tell Sandy I said hi.
exactly. But like, they're the coolest, and I learned so much from working with those actors, but they don't give me any problem. Like, they're there to up my game, and I, you know, it's really collaborative.
If you, as long as you bring your A game with actors like that, and not only actors like that, DPs at that level, production, when you're working with an Oscar-winning DP, better know what you're talking about. And you don't need to know his job or her job.
No, absolutely.
You don't need to know about glass.
Light, you know, you have to know what you want. And that's where I'm so involved with the shot list, especially because I often act in things that I direct too. So I have to have such a relationship with my DP that for this last movie, Mid-Century, the last week, I'm like acting in it for 5 days. And I had 4 weeks first where I'm just directing, and we did the schedule that way deliberately. So, you know, by then you could relax a little bit more in the last week. But those days that I'm acting and directing,
How do you do that? The one scene, the one or two scenes that I acted in the movie we were together, I was playing myself. I was playing myself, and I was just like, it was just so awkward and it was weird. And it was just like, how do you, it's such a weird, I think every director listening should act in a scene with an actor just once so they can see. So, because I saw your performance, you were like right next to me in the scene that we did together, and you would say stuff that would be like so audacious that I even told you, like, I'm a disenfranchised millennial. I was like, I said, cut. I want to slap you with that line. Oh my God, that's so obnoxious. That's brilliant. Let's do it again. But being in the movie and watching it from that perspective is such a weird experience for a director, because we're usually separated.
Yes.
It's so I'd love to hear your point, because I mean, I don't consider what I did acting. I was just playing myself.
Great cameo. I mean, I don't know. For me, it's sort of trusting those collaborators, right? Because even the days that I'm acting and getting to sit in hair and makeup and like I'm having to like be holding my little monitor and I'm still like directing, at some point I have to turn off my director hat and be an actor in order to give the performance in my own movie that is going to be solid. So it's just on those days, really handing it over, knowing that my DP knows exactly what I'm trying to go for and trusting those around me. And you feel like you're in a theater troupe at that point and everyone has your back and everyone's rooting for you to succeed and trying it different ways and just trusting and not being at the monitor and not trying to like do two things at once, because then I can just see it in an actor's performance when they're like backseat directing. So it's like just trying to be present with my scene partner. And I've been lucky, like in this movie, I had a scene with Shane West, and I grew up, like I saw Walk to Remember when I was like a teenager,
sure.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And like, you kind of have like a talent crush on these people, but it's just trying to be present in the scene. And then as soon as I'm done that scene, then I can go back to being the director. And then later in the edit, I might be extra anal about those scenes because there are certain things that maybe I micromanage and you're like, oh God, why did I do that or whatever. But it's really fun and you feel very alive. But I try not to do three at once. Like if I'm acting, writing and directing, like I think ideally I don't do more than two of those things in the same movie.
Right, because it's a lot. It's a lot. It's a lot. It's so interesting. It's so interesting because when you know, I've had the experience now because of the show to, you know, speak and have long conversations with some amazing filmmakers, some that I grew up with, some that I have talent. I love the talent crush. I love that term, talent crush. Yeah. But, you know, at a certain point, you know, that lasts for a minute. Because I'm sure the first day when Bruce Dern walked on set, you were just oh my God. But as a professional, you have to like, I can't geek out right now. Yeah.
I don't geek out. My rule is I don't geek out till ADR. When the movie's in the can, that's when I can actually be a little starstruck. But before then, we are just peers. We are on a set.
Right.
We are co-workers. And it's like, you can't let any of that like mysticism about this person that you grew up watching. But by ADR, that's the only time I'll ever take a selfie with an actor. Before then, I'm like a little more closed off and I'm just trying to do my job and I can't see what a big deal they are.
Like,
you know?
Yeah, like you can't go on set on the first day and just take a shot with them. Like, it's so unprofessional. You want to though.
I want to so badly, but I've just learned that I have to keep, like there's just a certain level of calm. I can't even let myself fangirl. Like you are there to do a job and you are there to make them have the quickest, most easy day possible. But then later, you know, when I become their friend, when you're promoting the film down the road, then they're like, oh my God, I had no idea you were even a fan, because I was like very chill.
It's similar to me when I'm talking to somebody, when I first meet them on the show, I'm like, okay, boom, boom, boom. And after an hour or 2 hours of conversations and the recording stops, I'm like, dude, okay, that movie that you did. And then I'll geek out, but I won't geek out prior to that because you can't. You just can't.
You can't. And you're having a rapport with them and you're both equals in that situation. You know, you're having a dialogue and you're being of service to other people. And that's what I kept on reminding myself. But later I'm like, oh my God, you're my favorite actor, you know?
So how do you, I love asking this question of directors who work with these kind of caliber actors. How did you approach directing a Bruce Dern or Steve Lang? Like, what was your literal approach to like directing them?
Well, I mean, I try to see everything they've done beforehand, so I'm never stumped, because Bruce Dern will throw an obscure movie at you and you kind of need to know the reference. So I want to know everything about them before. I try to read interviews before to talk about what their process is. Both Bruce Dern and Stephen Lang are actors studio guys, and I was an observer at their actors studio in New York. So I knew that I could talk to them about sort of method things and talk to them about private moments and just geek out about these things. And then I try to ask people just directly, like, how do you work, you know?
Right.
And I'm just really cognizant of never getting in the way of the process, never, ever giving someone a line reading. Like, it's really just sort of respectful. You know what I mean? Like, there were times that you have in your head, like, a certain idea of how you might want something to go. And then these people are going to throw such a different direction at you that you just have to be so, like, you are in awe of their ability. And I relinquish control, and it might go a different way than I want, but it's going to make me look good if I'm supportive of the thing that they're going to do anyway. And then just watching them do a take before I ever do give them any sort of direction, and sort of earning that, you know, back and forth with them, and trying not to get too heady, because there were a couple times in the beginning that, like, I could write an essay on what every scene means, and, like, letting that go and trying to just, you know, sometimes it's so much simpler than you think, and you're like, wow, this is brilliant. And I don't know. I mean, I think it's just like being kind and open, and, you know, they're experts, and they'll make you look good if you're just, you know, in any way, like, open and present, you know?
Yeah, no.
Actors are harder to direct than pros. That's how I kind of see it.
I agree with you 110%. Professionals, yeah, who've been around forever, who are, you know, sometimes legendary, these guys and gals both, they just show up. They do their job. They know what their lines are. It's the younger actors. It's the more inexperienced, yeah, actors. It's the more insecure actors, yeah, who are the problems that you have to.
And that's where a lot of my day will be, working with somebody, right, who's more inexperienced, and the bigger actors. But it's also like trusting that I have something to say, and that my directions are worthwhile, and that we're in this together. And I've gotten far more confident about, like, saying what needs to be said without, you know, worrying that maybe I'll offend someone. Because I think if you're invested in them having a great performance, and you're both together trying to make a great movie, you're just collaborating. And I try to not think about their stature or anything else. If you're just trying to make a cool fucking movie.
You're right. And they would, and they appreciate that. Cause if you, yeah, are like, do you know who you are? Like, yeah, you can't, that hurts the process, because,
yes,
that might be fun for a minute, but then you've got to.
Right. No. Yeah. And I mean, like, I'm an actor and they're an actor, and maybe we're doing a scene together, or maybe I'm watching them doing a scene, but, like, I don't know. We're just in it together, and your team members together. And that's really, like, given me a lot of calm going onto set with these people. I'm like, we're just in it together.
Did you, what was a big lesson you picked up from Bruce as far as acting, or Steve, from just an actor's perspective? You're like, wow, I'm putting that, yeah, in my toolbox.
I mean, Bruce does a thing called doing a Jernsey, where he makes you at the end of any take to just keep rolling until he basically says cut, and he's going to throw out some improv things, and they're usually gems. And it was interesting watching Stephen Lang, who doesn't really do that, and Bruce, who's going to wing it and, like, do a total bit, and seeing them work off of each other. So, you know, not calling cut too soon and sort of, like, letting them have their human behavior was something that was cool. And then Bruce likes his actors. Bruce reads lips, and it's really hard in a time of COVID with masks, because he's 85 years old, right? And he wants to be able to read your lips in order for him to be able to hear things. So, like, that was tough. Like, there were some miscommunications of just, you know, that's a challenge. And he likes his actors to be, I mean, his director to be, like, really close. Like, you're not back at Video Village. And I'm like that anyway. Like, I'm on the ground next to a scene with my mini monitor. Like, I'm, like, right in the action. But he said he doesn't like directors that are, like, distant and removed. And he likes people that are just really open and forthright. And, like, I just learned so much from, like, just the way that he talks about movies. I mean, it's like being in a master class, but still trying to make us make our day, because he could tell stories.
Right.
And you're like, this is the best. It's film school, but I also need you to do this thing right now. And you'll laugh and, like, do the thing. But
no, know, that's
it's a challenge.
to say the least. No, that's awesome. Cause I have to ask you, is there something that you wish you could tell your younger self? Is there something that you could go back and that you just didn't, like, man, I wish somebody would have told me this?
Yeah. I mean, I think that with auditions and casting, I see such incredible actors all the time auditioning for my projects that are wonderful, and they're not getting the part because they're literally not the type that you need to serve that story and do that thing. And I just thought I was awful and untalented all the time when I was younger. Like, the amount of time that I just beat myself up about not getting something, and it was so completely out of my control, and it had nothing to do with my ability. So just hearing, like, you are enough, you have talent, you have a voice, and you're going to have the career you want, but be patient. Like, I had no patience, you know, like I just wanted everything 10 minutes ago. And, you know, I think it was just chilling out, like, was really important. And I had no chill, you know.
I'd argue you still have very little chill, but
they call me no chill Sonia. Yeah,
no, I mean, but that's the energy you have when you're young, is that you just are like this energy. You're like, I want. Like when I was in my 20s, I'm like, why hasn't Hollywood figured out I'm a genius yet?
No.
What is going on? I should be directing major motion pictures at this point in my life. I mean, Orson Welles did it at 23. Spielberg did it at 27. I mean, how old was Lucas when he did Star Wars? Like, I mean, and you start doing that kind of crap to yourself. Yes. Yeah. And we'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show. I always ask this question, which I'll ask you in a second. Like, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn? For me, it's patience. It's patience. It's patience. Yeah. It's patience. And I'll drop a name from one of my former guests, Richard Linklater, who said the best advice he gave. He's like, however long you think it's going to take to get to make your movie, it's going to be twice as long, and it's going to take twice as long. Sure. And no, twice as long and twice as hard.
For sure.
Yeah. And he's still hustling it. Still going after it.
You end up like achieving the things that you've always wanted. And then you realize like that your idea of like achieving the goal feels good for a second. Like when I got my Daytime Emmy nomination last year, all I wanted was to be able to be like, I'm an Emmy nominee. And then you get it. And then you still feel like a big imposter. And it still doesn't, like, you know what I mean? It's like anytime you get the goal, it feels good for a second, and then you're still back to being yourself and stuck in your own head with your own fears. And that's sort of forever.
It's the best piece of advice I could say to people is that life, and specifically our career, but life in general, is the journey, not the event.
It is. And it sounds so cheesy, and like it's so hard for people to understand it, but like I love what I do. I am going to do this at freaking 98 years old. I'm certainly going to be acting, writing, and directing. It's the great love of my life doing this stuff. And it's such a privilege to get to do it. And like, sometimes you have good years and sometimes you don't, but like everyone, no matter what stage they in that they're making it, they're still feeling like they're not enough and that they're not talented. And like, that doesn't really go away. And I always just imagined one day I'd have the big agency and I'd be doing bigger movies and that my life would be without problems and that like everything would feel hunky dory. And I still am like the nerd I was at 17 in acting school in New York. Like that doesn't change, you know?
No, absolutely. And one thing I'd love to just touch upon is that imposter syndrome. It is something that I've asked the biggest, most accomplished writers and directors in Hollywood who've won Oscars, who've won Emmys, who are legends, and they all say it. I have imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. I still have it. And I'm like, but you made friends. You know, and Martha Kaufman, who's going to come on the show in a few weeks, said, yeah, I still have it every day. And I'm like, like security is going to walk in and go, oh, what are you doing here? You're not supposed to be directing. Who gave you security? Get her out of here, or get him out of here.
Yeah,
it's a weird thing
all the time.
But that's an artist.
Yeah, that's just art. And I think that you have to be vulnerable to make good art. And letting yourself be vulnerable lets like the demons come in a little bit to make you feel like, why do you deserve this opportunity? And like, why does anything I say matter? And like that happens. But I just try to tell myself, somebody was going to get this job. Why not me? You know what, like, you know, that like we're all trying our best and like I'm just going to keep on making movies. And you just have to remind yourself that like you have intrinsic worth and you have something to say. And that whenever people talk about waiting until the perfect circumstance to make the movie, I always get upset because that's never going to happen. And growth is inherently uncomfortable, right? So the first time I ever do a new movie, I feel deeply uncomfortable and I feel like I can't physically do it. And meanwhile, I've gone into pitch on that movie where I've tried to convince everyone, oh yeah, this is so easy. I've got this. I'm going to give you the best movie ever. And then I get involved with the creative process and then you doubt everything. But I think that's part of what makes work good.
But
right?
That's the process.
Right.
I mean, that happens with everybody, every director at any stage of their career.
Yeah.
They're still trying to figure it out. They're still like, it's brand new to them. You know, again, and I've had that privilege of talking to these amazing artists, and you just start to realize, you're like, you put them up on a pedestal.
Yeah.
But they're filmmakers. They're writers. Mm-hmm. They go through the same. They have to make their day. Yeah. The camera might not work. The light might be going away on a $200 million movie and on a $1 million movie. They struggle with the same. The process is the same. The paintbrushes are different. The players might be different, but if I might use a baseball or football analogy, if you're playing it with your friends on a field, high school football is the exact same as professional NFL football.
Yeah, sure, right.
But at a whole other level, and a whole other speed, and a whole other level of performance. But the game is the game, no matter who you are and at what level you're at. The game doesn't change. And that's you know, you could be playing on a sand lot or you could be playing in a major stadium. You hit the ball, you catch the ball, you throw the ball.
Yeah, and I always feel better with directing. It's such a collaboration, right? Like
you
trust department heads and you trust the people you're working with. Like it feels like we're all in it together. Writing is a process that's far more painful for me because I feel like it's all me sharing my most, like my demons on the page and that I'm going to be skewered for it. And like, it's just such a different, more vulnerable process to me and much harder for me to do it. Like I can daily show up to set and be a director and give my all. And I'm like that with acting too. But writing is like one of those things that I'm crippled with levels of like, you know, the imposter syndrome in a different way. So I think we all have like different things that, you know, come easier. And like writing will always feel like purging something really significant, you know.
That's amazing. Now I'm gonna ask you a few questions to ask all my guests. Mm-hmm. What advice would you give a filmmaker or screenwriter trying to break into the business today?
Make your micro budget feature. Just go and do it. No excuses. Like make this thing yesterday, because you will not have somebody else give you money until you've put your heart and soul and finances into that first project. So go make it, because that's the only reason I have a career.
And sell your eggs.
And sell your eggs. Absolutely.
If you have eggs to sell, finance your first feature that way. Absolutely. Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
I think finding your tribe. Like there's an urge when you first start to get into the industry that you want to reach up to people that are ahead of you. And I think that you're going to find most of your valuable collaborators with people that you're currently in acting class with, or you're making that student film with. And those collective of artists that were my own peers are people that I'm now bringing with me from project to project. And that feels really good. So realize the worth in the people around you.
And three of your favorite films of all time.
Ooh, Mulholland Drive is probably my favorite film of all time. All About Eve, the Betty Davis film. Yes. I love.
That makes sense.
And I've been really obsessed with Fincher's films recently. So
you're talking to a Fincher fanatic. And I had Jeff Cronenworth, his DP, on the show. And we so geeked out on his process and how he works. He's been working with him since Fight Club. So, you know, he did Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and Social Network. I'm like, dude, Social Network, how'd you get that shot? How'd you do this? How'd you do that? Like, it was just fascinating. But yeah, Fincher, no question.
And Black Swan. I feel like I want to make a movie like Black Swan. I think psychological haunting stories of ambition are what keep me up at night and what I'm interested in making.
That makes sense. And I think Julia would definitely like All About Eve. I think that's definitely on her top three. And what's up next for you? I know you've got 1,000 projects going on. You should be doing the next Avengers soon. What's happening?
No, my movie Mid-Century is going to be coming out this year.
Nice.
And we've signed with a very cool distributor, and you'll see news in the trade sometime soon about that. So that will be coming out. And then my series Doomsday that got the Emmy nomination will be released on VOD and demand on all the streamers on March 1st.
Very cool. And how about the other film you have going on?
The other feature is in post right now, and it's about to make its festival premiere. So I'll be able to announce some information about that soon.
Sonia, I am so happy for you and all your success. And it's so fun for me because I literally was there at the beginning of this part of your journey. And I'm so glad I had a small part in helping you get to where you are today just by casting you in a movie. I'm not taking any credit whatsoever for what you've done,
you were fundamental to where I
I'm not hunting for a compliment, but I'm just glad that I could be part of the journey in one small way. And I'm really glad to see it. And I every time I go on Facebook, I see your happy face pop up. I'm like, hey, you know, it's me and Quentin. We're just hanging out. And I'm like, that didn't happen. But that's the kind of stuff I'm like, oh, good for her, man. I'm so happy for you. So continued success. I cannot wait to see the films you make in the future. And I hope this interview inspires a lot of other directors and female directors out there to tell their stories. So I appreciate you.
Thank you, Alex.
I want to thank Sonia so much for coming on the show and sharing her journey with us. Thank you so much, Sonia. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to watch some of Sonia's amazing work, head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/189. And if you haven't already, please head over to screenwritingpodcast.com, subscribe, and leave a good review for the show. It truly helps us out a lot. Thank you again so much for listening, guys. As always, keep on writing, no matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.